Historians. I'm your host, Heather Ashley, and welcome to another episode of Women of Her Story, a podcast dedicated to celebrating women who have made or are making their mark in our society. Please welcome my co-host, Gregor Cheddar. You ready for a wild ride, Gregor?
Oh, I'm so ready. Thank you very much. I appreciate you for having me here today. You know, there's a nor'eastern going on.
Oh, so yeah.
Yeah.
You know, We're recording this during a big old blizzard.
They had to fly me in last night so I could do this in the studio. So thank you very much for having me.
Yeah.
Fly me out all the way here from Iceland.
Far.
Yeah, it was a long plane ride. Anyway.
Yes, anyway. Yeah, today we have kind of a wild ride. I would like to do a tiny little baby disclaimer and say that there is a portion about a quarter of the way through today's episode that does discuss some abuse, and that's, you know, just a little bit of a heads up, trigger warning. But it's nothing too crazy. It's just, you know that that's coming.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Today, we're going to be talking about the legendary journalist Nellie Bly, whose undercover investigative journalism in the 1800s helped to usher in an entirely new brand of journalists.
Well, I'm excited. I'm strapped in and I'm ready.
Let's do it. Nellie Bly was born Elizabeth Jane Cochran on May 5th, 1864 in Cochran, Pennsylvania. Her father, Michael Cochran, founded the town and owned a lucrative mill. He even ascended to a judgeship position. Him being a landowner and a judge allowed the family to enjoy a certain level of comfort.
That's so cool to be related to someone who owns a town.
Who owns a town,
it's
right?
Kind of like, no, I mean, it's like a Schitt's Creek. Just
oh, like, yeah, you know? Yeah, just like Schitt's Creek, yeah, where you're like, this is my town.
That's my town.
Her mother, Mary Jane, and her father were both on their second marriages after both of their first spouses had passed. Michael had 10 children with his first wife.
Goodness.
And 5 more with Mary Jane.
Never busy. Never slow.
Never not
busy. Never a dull moment, yeah.
15 kids, can't. But,
nope.
I mean, that also, if you think about it, that means probably, like, by the time, you know, the 11th one is born, the first 8 are like out of the house anyway. So
I don't even want to think of the name that HG or those shows would have, like
Kate and 8 and all that. Yeah,
15 and dead. You know, like I can't even think of like what like after 8. That's
yeah,
so much.
That's
anyway.
So many. Well, tragedy struck the Large family when Elizabeth was just 6 years old. Her father died suddenly without a will, and left his wife no legal claim to the estate. So, the wealth was split amongst his 10 children from his first wife, leaving Elizabeth's mother and all of her children with very little. Which is just, it's kind of like what we were talking with Bina West and her with the life insurance, and you couldn't legally sign things. And the family couldn't maintain the land or the house and were forced to move to Pittsburgh. Mary Jane remarried but was quickly divorced due to abuse she was suffering at his hands.
Oh.
Yeah. Elizabeth knew she had to start earning money to alleviate some of the financial stress, so she enrolled in the Indiana Teachers College around the age of 15 with the hopes of becoming a teacher. Due to the family's financial crisis, after just a year and a half, she was forced to leave the school. She focused on helping her mother run a boarding house. And it was around this time that she ended up adding an E to the end of her name, feeling like it sounded a little more high class. So I think that would be Cochran instead of Cochran.
Oh, okay, yes, yeah.
You know? One day, after reading an article in the Pittsburgh Dispatch, she penned an open, angry letter to the editor for the paper's negative representation of women. Erasmus Wilson, known as the Quiet Observer, or QO. to dispatch readers, wrote something that put flames on the side of my face. Mm. So he claimed that women were best served by conducting domestic duties and called the working woman a, quote, monstrosity.
Well,
he further stated that women are to be a helpmate to a man.
Helpmate?
Yeah, yeah. He made just it, a servant. Made just it, to serve.
A helpmate.
Yeah. And for a quiet observer, he is awfully loud and should sit down before I build a time machine and
punch him into the next
little Erasmus timeline. Face.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, with a name like that, you can bet that he was already punched several times, you know, in his life.
Her letter to editor George Madden was signed, quote, Lonely Orphan Girl. He not only read it, but he printed her rebuttal and offered her a job as a columnist.
Okay.
I know.
I mean, yeah, that's how you do it.
That's how you do it.
Shouldn't have happened in the first place, no. But there you go.
It was here that Elizabeth took on the pen name Nellie Bly, taken from a Stephen Foster song. At the Pittsburgh Dispatch, she was working as a reporter for $5 a week, which is about $134 today. Nellie wanted to highlight the negative consequences of the sexist ideologies of the time that were widely accepted to simply be true. She wanted to show the importance of women's rights issues and to expose what life really looked like. She posed as a sweatshop worker to expose poor working conditions faced by women. This, of course, angered the local factory owners. And not wanting to be in bad graces with these owners, the editor moved Nellie from her hard-hitting reporting to the society pages. To escape having to write a glorified gossip column, Nellie volunteered to travel to Mexico and lived there as a correspondent for 6 months.
Yeah.
She was like, put me anywhere.
Yeah.
Hoping to be moved back to her original post upon her return, she was disappointed to learn that she was to be put right back into the society pages. Nellie wanted to write about issues that affected both men and women. So she left the Dispatch to look for a paper that would let her write serious pieces.
Good.
In 1886, she moved to New York City, a city full to the brim with various publications, hoping to find one willing to give a woman a chance. She faced numerous rejections simply because she was a woman. But she finally found her place at New York World at 23 years old in 1887.
Wow, good for her.
I know.
New York World.
She approached her editor, none other than the Joseph Pulitzer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. About wanting to write a story about the immigrant experience in the United States. He had a different idea. Joseph Pulitzer told Nellie to go and investigate one of New York's most notorious mental hospitals.
Oh.
And before you ask, yes, Sarah Paulson's character, Lana Winters, on The American Horror Story Asylum was based on Nellie Bly. So you can kind of guess where this is going.
That's kind of cool that, I mean, you know, it wasn't the initial idea that she had in mind, but the fact that he gave her another kind
and
of opportunity.
And he trusted her with it, too.
Is just as nice, I guess. We're about to find out, but yeah, that was a crazy season. Anyway,
the plan? Feign a mental illness to gain admission and expose how the patients were really treated there.
Mm.
She threw herself into the role of a deranged woman to be committed. In the articles she later published, she said that she practiced looking insane in front of a mirror and that the idea that, quote, far away expressions have a crazy air.
Oh, boy.
She checked herself into a working-class boarding house, hoping to scare the other boarders enough to get kicked out. She used the name Nellie Brown, and she pretended to be from Cuba and ranted on and on more and more aggressively that she was searching for missing trunks. And wouldn't you know, it worked, and the police were called. And then she pretty quickly had a hearing at a New York City court, and the judge ordered her to Blackwell's Island.
Whoa.
Yeah. The island.
She sold that.
Oh, so, sold that so really well. Much. She
Good
was
for
like,
her.
She, you know, she was already going undercover with things. She invested. And I think she's one of those people that's like, all right, how am I gonna make this happen? Mm-hmm. So the island, now known as Roosevelt Island, housed a poorhouse, a smallpox hospital, a prison, and an insane asylum. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, it's now one of the pricier parts of the city to live in.
It's so nice. I feel like there's
it's definitely haunted, though.
There's like two or three like supermarkets on the island. There's one train stop. I actually drove around with two of my friends the island. It took us like maybe...
Around it.
Right, but like I can tell you that like you can drive around the whole like that maybe the whole island in like less than like 25 minutes.
Yeah, it's very small.
Short. We actually drove by the asylum too. It was still operable. This was like about a decade ago.
After the judge sentenced her to the island, Nellie later recalls a very interesting conversation. "What is this place?" I asked of the man who had his fingers sunk into the flesh of my arm. "Blackwell's Island, an insane place where you'll never get out of."
Oh.
Hey, right?
Bleak.
Really, really bleak. And this is when the trigger warning comes into effect from earlier. Nellie wrote this about her first night at the institution. "Nearly all night long, I listened to a woman cry about the cold and beg for God to let her die. Another one yelled murder at frequent intervals and police at others until my flesh felt creepy." She wrote about the deplorable conditions in the asylum. Bread was spread with rancid butter, and her plain piece was hard and had a, quote, dirty black color. I found a spider in my slice, so I didn't eat it. The tea, quote, tasted as if it had been made in copper. The oatmeal and molasses were wretched, and on day two, she was served soup with a cold boiled potato and a chunk of beef, which, on investigation, proved to be slightly spoiled.
Ew. That's gross.
Yeah. Commenting on these things, she said, "To have a good brain, the stomach must be cared for." The draft went whizzing through the hall. The patients looked blue with cold.
Mm.
Within the first few days, Nellie was forced into an ice-cold bath in dirty water. There were two coarse towels to be shared among 45 patients. My teeth chattered and my limbs were goose-fleshed and blue with cold. Suddenly, I got one after the other 3 buckets of water over my head, ice-cold water, too, into my eyes, my nose, and my mouth. I think I experienced the sensation of a drowning person as they dragged me, gasping and shivering and quaking from the tub. For once, I did not look insane. And despite the fact that this was in autumn in New York City, they were given threadbare dresses and poorly fitted undergarments after these freezing baths.
Those are atrocious accommodations. I can't believe that they were able to stay open for
to get away with it. Yeah. They just power horrible things.
Yeah.
She said, "But here, let me say one thing. From the moment I entered the insane ward on the island, I made no attempt to keep up the assumed role of insanity. I talked and acted just as I do in ordinary life. Yet strange to say, the more sanely I talked and acted, the crazier I was thought to be by all except one physician, whose kindness and gentle ways I shall not soon forget."
Well, I wonder... I can't even imagine that trying to almost like being normal and then you end up sounding just as crazy or coming off just as crazy as everyone else.
Bridget McGinnis, a patient at the asylum, said to Bly, "The beatings I got there were something dreadful. I was pulled around by the hair, held underwater until I strangled, and I was choked and kicked. It was hopeless to complain to the doctors, for they always said it was the imagination of our diseased brains, and besides, we could get another beating for telling."
Yeah.
"Nurses drugged inmates with, quote, so much morphine and chloral that the patients are made crazy."
Oh.
"The attendants seemed to find amusement and pleasure in exciting violent patients to do their worst." 10 days after her entry, the lawyers from New York World arranged for her release. This is all in a week and a half.
10 days. That's
incredible. And I didn't even list all the things that she wrote in her articles.
Sure. Oh, God.
She said she hated leaving behind the suffering women, but at the same time, she was eager to write about everything that she had seen.
Yeah, she needed to. Ugh.
It is only after one is in trouble that one realizes how little sympathy and kindness there is in the world. The New York World published her articles on her time in the insane asylum in two parts. The first part was an illustrated series on the front page Sunday feature section. And I can picture all of these people in, like, Victorian clothing being like, oh, what? What? Like, I'm just seeing these fancy people in my brain and then picking up this paper. It's like the late 1800s. Yeah. It's just crazy to think about. And the second installment was full of all sorts of attention-grabbing headlines, bylines, and the like. Inside the Madhouse, Nellie Bly's experience in the Blackwell's Island Asylum, how the city's unfortunate wards are fed and treated, the terrors of cold baths and cruel, unsympathetic nurses.
Yeah, this perspective needed to get out. This is horrible.
After these were published, she became one of the most famous journalists in the U.S. The story was so explosive that random competing newspapers actually published their own accounts of Bly's experience.
Oh.
Just to be like, oh, we have the scoop too.
Wow.
Yeah, crazy. The brutal and violent account by a 23-year-old, quote, girl detective shocked everyone. According to Brooke Kroger, writers like Charles Dickens and Margaret Fuller had toured insane asylums and written about them, but those were guided tours and they didn't see much. Bly lived alongside women who were violent, suicidal, psychotic, and even sane women who had been mistakenly confined to the institution.
Good God.
I'm going to list just a few of the little reasons women could be committed. God.
I'm sure it was definitely reasonable for its time. Of course, they had some sort of...
This list is titled...
Like, this woman blinked. This woman breathed. Oh, this woman moved just without permission.
This list was titled Reasons for Admission, West Virginia Hospital for the Insane, October 22nd, 1864 to December 12th, 1889.
She moved.
This is just a few.
She was a woman.
Here it is. Asthma. Bad company. Bad habits and political excitement, bad whiskey, bite of a rattlesnake, business nerves, death of sons in the war, desertion by husband, disappointed love, dog bite, exposure and quackery, fell from horse, female disease, fever and loss of lawsuit, fighting fire, imaginary female trouble, immoral life, indigestion, jealousy, laziness, liver and social disease, loss of arm, masturbation for 30 years, menstrual deranges, mental excitement, overaction of the mind, politics, uterine derangement, woman, young lady and fear.
I like woman. I like woman. Woman.
Why are you committing her to an insane asylum?
She's
woman.
She's womanly, so we have to. I like quackery. They definitely have you in the asylum for quackery.
Quackery.
Yeah, with the
disappointed love. Also, why is a dog bite being treated at an insane asylum? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, snake. Yeah, well, yeah.
Snake bite.
Yeah.
Fell from horse.
Woman.
What?
It's so stupid.
It's just crazy. It's
so
just
messed
crazy.
Up. They're looking for any. They literally just listed reasons. They weren't even like.
Yeah.
That's
they
great.
Don't. Yeah. Here's
woman.
Isn't that crazy? Imaginary female trouble might be my favorite.
That's a good one too. That is a good one too. Masturbation over 30 years.
Yeah,
29 and you're fine. 28 and you're getting
yeah.
30?
Yeah. 30? Oh, that's the limit.
Whoa.
Yeah, too much. Too much.
Come on.
So this is a little excerpt from one of her articles. A pretty young Hebrew woman who spoke so little English I could not get her story except as told by the nurses. They said her name is Sarah Fishbaum and that her husband put her in the asylum because she had a fondness of other men than himself. Here was a woman taken without her own consent from the free world to an asylum, and there given no chance to prove her sanity. Confined most probably for life behind asylum bars without even being told in her language why and wherefore. Compare this with a criminal who is given every chance to prove his innocence. Who would not rather be a murderer and take the chance for life than be declared insane without hope of escape? Just
wow.
Ugh. I was so sweaty researching all of this.
I'm sweaty right now, actively.
Nellie's approach to her stories developed into what is now called investigative journalism.
That's so cool.
And soon after the release of the articles, city officials began investigations of the institution.
That's great.
The investigation was led by New York Assistant District Attorney Vernon M. Davis, with Bly assisting. A month later, a grand jury went with Bly to visit the asylum, but they were too late.
Oh, wait, Vernon Davis. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The inmates who talked to her had been transferred or released, quote unquote. The building had been scrubbed down and patients had better food and water. She said, quote, I would like the expert physicians who are condemning me for my action, which has proven their ability to take a perfectly sane and healthy woman, shut her up, and make her sit from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m. on straight back benches, do not allow her to talk or move during these hours, give her bad food and harsh treatment, and see how long it will take to make her insane. 2 months would make her a mental and physical wreck. Fortunately, the grand jury believed Bly.
Thank goodness.
And officials added nearly $1 million to the asylum's budget, which is about $27 million today. Additional appointments for stronger supervision of nurses and other healthcare workers, regulations to prevent overcrowding and fire hazards at the city's medical facilities were then implemented. And 2 months later, 10 Days in a Madhouse was released as a book. Brooke Kroger, the author of Nellie Bly, Daredevil, Reporter, Feminist, said this in an interview. She was a courageous crusader to let herself be committed into an insane asylum with no guarantee that she'd be able to leave.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's they could, the ju- like, a judge could, just getting the wrong judge to sign her release.
Right.
Could have been.
It could only take one person. Yep. It really only needs.
Yep.
It's really only one person that could sway the whole thing for her. So thank goodness.
Yeah.
She was able to get out as, you know, as unscathed or as, you know, as, I guess as, I'll say it as unscathed as she was.
Yeah. As quickly, and she was able to, like, go in, get out, you know. And
still preserve her mental state as a 23-year-old.
She said, I said I could and I would and I did.
Damn.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, Kroger said she was part of the stunt girl movement that was very important in the 1880s and 1890s as these big, mass circulation yellow journalism papers came into the fore. She was referred to as a muckraker, an activist journalist who wrote about the problems in society with the goal of motivating readers to take action. She wrote exposés of baby-selling rackets and harsh conditions for factory workers, improper treatment of individuals in New York jails and factories, as well as corruption in state legislature. She interviewed the likes of Emma Goldman and Susan B. Anthony. After reading Jules Verne's book, Around the World in 80 Days, Nellie decided to follow the same route as the fictitious character Phileas Fogg.
I love that she was like, she still wanted to do more after
after the asylum scandal.
Mm-hmm. You know, like, some people would have just been like, yeah, that's good enough,
and yeah, they're like, did my part.
She's like, this fictitious character, I'm going to top that. Like, she set that standard for herself, and I guess I applaud that. That's cool.
She ended up completing her trip around the world in a world record 72 days.
I read about that.
Which held for a few months, but then it did end up getting beat. But It was...
No, she could still say she was, like, she's in the books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She traveled light, only taking the dress she wore, a cape, and a small traveler's bag.
Me too.
She said she wanted to make this trip to prove that women were capable of traveling just as well as, if not better than, men.
Mm-hmm.
And she packed light to challenge the notion that women have to travel with many suitcases and various vanity items.
Like,
yeah, yeah, me too. This excursion gave her international attention. She was printed on playing cards and various merchandise. Oh, she was
I would
all
love to see
over
a playing card
the
of her.
World.
I, you know, damn, that's really cool. I bet they had the kind of like Bazooka Joe gum where it's like they had pictures
just the little,
of her inside you know, because they always had those with like comic books of like Dilbert and Dennis the Menace. So I wonder if they had that, because trading cards for like, you know, innovative and influential people, I feel like now just come as a novelty thing when you buy like
Or like
more specifically, if you buy like a woman's product and then it's like 50 cards of like influential women.
Oh, I
know,
see what
I
you're
mean?
Saying.
Where it's like, I don't know when that would happen before. If you got like a deck of cards, I think it'd be like, it would be like just the regular cards, or it'd specifically be like, you know, a theme, but it'd be like Western theme.
Yeah,
so it'd be you know, Dirty Harry.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah,
That's
so interesting.
I know.
Trading cards of her. I'd love to see that. I wonder if there are trading cards of like other. I'm sure there are, but I wonder how prevalent they were when they first started. Like when hers first came out, I wonder how hard it was to get one, or I wonder if it was just in like a newspaper or something.
Right. I don't know.
It's interesting.
I wonder. She, like I said, had international fame. Upon returning to New York, Nellie expected a bonus or at least some recognition for her incredible feat and the amount of
She can get anything like that as well.
Of work she had done. Actually, Joseph Pulitzer barely even acknowledged her. So she quit. She quit the New York World, quote, in disgust, according to Kroger, because she's like, wow, give me, like, look at this thing that I've done. And truthfully, I'm a little torn. Hear me out. Because of all the work that she did, this one seems the least, like, consequential in terms of, like, social importance, which seemed to be what mattered more to Pulitzer and the New York World. But on the other hand, he could have, like, let her ride that high and maybe, like, find something deeper.
Yeah, it's dumb.
But, yeah, really, really interesting that that happened.
Bad choice.
I mean, they did. She was welcomed back, but I mean, like, within the newspaper. She was expecting at least a little something.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. In 1895, Nellie married millionaire Robert Seaman and retired from journalism.
Well, there you go.
Robert owned the Ironclad Manufacturing Company and the American Steel Barrel Company.
Okay.
Sadly, he died just 8 years later in 1903, leaving Nellie in control of the massive manufacturing company.
I was just going to say, this is, you know, unfortunate about his death, but after not getting the money.
She flourished.
You know, like, at the beginning, early stages of her life, this she deserves this.
Oh, yes, yes.
She deserves
She absolutely
money.
Flourished in this role. She even patented inventions related to oil manufacturing that we still use to this day.
Okay.
Right. And, you know, it's no surprise that she did end up returning to journalism in 1911, because you can't keep somebody like that away from writing.
Well, I like that she was also a lady oil baroness.
Yeah, right. She covered the women's suffrage movement, and she attended the Women's Suffrage Parade of 1913 in Washington, D.C., and in a piece she wrote, she argues that women were as capable as men in all things.
True.
Yes, she covered World War I. When Nellie traveled to Europe, she was the first woman to report from the trenches on the front line.
Oh, she did everything then.
Oh my gosh. Now, so sadly, Nellie Bly died from pneumonia on January 27th of 1922 at the age of 57.
It is very sad.
While she never reached the same level of stardom and acclaim that she once held, she continually used her writing to shed light on the issues of the day. A memorial was supposed to be erected for her on Roosevelt Island at the tip of the Lighthouse Park in late 2020, but I couldn't find if it had been able to be unveiled due to, like, COVID restrictions. And so I believe, based on what I could find, it should be going up this year. But, yeah, hopefully, hopefully it does. The piece is by artist Amanda Matthews, and it is titled The Girl Puzzle. It features sculptures of Bly and four faces of women and girls who she interviewed for her expose. There are 5 7-foot sculptures.
Oh my goodness.
I know. Quote, rendered in partial sections that appear like giant puzzle pieces that reflect being broken and repaired.
I like that imagery. Right? That's very good.
Wait, there's more.
Oh.
Running through the middle, there are 3 shiny stainless steel spheres, each one getting...
Say that 5 times.
You can't say shiny stainless steel spheres. Very fast.
You almost did that. No, you did. Just 4 more times.
Yeah,
no, it's fine.
Each one getting larger. And that, quote, represents an amplification of her voice over time.
Ooh.
Each represents a period in her life, starting with her career at the Pittsburgh Dispatch, her investigative work on Blackwell Island, and her around-the-world trip represented by the largest sphere.
That's, yeah, that makes sense, honestly. That's incredible.
The artist said, as you enter the space, you see each of the faces, and then you will see the surrounding land, and then you'll see yourself. So hopefully, you will understand that this is a sacred place with sacred stories, and you can see yourself as part of the story.
See, that's excellent because, you know, even though she wasn't given her just desserts while she was alive, you know, she was still... we were still able to look up to her and learn from what she had done and make sure that she had gotten that credit or, you know, at least erected like a memorial for her and her accomplishments. I think that's very important for the unsung heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. And for someone who's so, you know, she really laid down some incredible groundwork for journalism as we know it today. Think of all these Netflix documentaries and Hulu documentaries that we love to watch. You know, they're going so deep and they're going so far into it, and not as law enforcement, but as investigators to tell the story. It's just, you know.
It's impressive. Yeah, she had a very impressive legacy, and she just wanted to keep excelling more and more after every accomplishment.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And I'm going to leave you guys with a little bit of a longer quote than I usually do.
Hmm.
She said, I always have a comfortable feeling that nothing is impossible if one applies a certain amount of energy in the right direction. When I want things done, which is always at the last moment, and I am met with such an answer, it's too late, I hardly think it can be done. I simply say nonsense. If you want to do it, you can do it. The question is, do you want to do it? Ooh.
Yeah, a woman after my own heart, absolutely. Get things done at the last minute.
Do it.
I'm always doing it.
I mean,
we're not celebrating last minute. That was the takeaway. Subscribe to all the channels. Wear a mask. This is it. That was it. That was the takeaway. No, that's very good, though. You know, even if she did things last minute, she still aced everything.
Oh, my God.
So, like, you know, just think of it as, like, she took all that time to finally do things at the last minute to prep to be where she could be in a position to succeed at the final hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's absolutely where her and I both kind of really exist. So good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like it. I love the idea. If you want to do it, you can do it. The question is, do you want to? If you want to, you'll make it happen.
That's right.
If you don't really want to do it, you're not going to get it done.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just...
then it's just...
yeah. It's
like, do I want to go outside in this blizzard?
No.
But,
like, maybe later.
No, right. Yeah, still no. Probably shouldn't.
Well, thank you, Herstorians, for tuning in again. Subscribe, tell every soul you know and the souls you don't.
All those lost souls.
All of them.
For all those lost souls that are looking
get
for
out
a
the
podcast,
Ouija board.
You know what I mean? Like, while you're trying to figure out your place in life, subscribe. Yeah, fun.
Come back this Friday for an interview with Allie Miles Jenkins, the founder of Boom Boss, a company geared toward and celebrating women over 50 who are delving into their own business ventures. In this interview, Allie tells us why she created Boom Boss, some of the struggles she faced, her best advice, and so much more.
Oh.
Yeah. Follow us on the social media, Twitter.
What voice is that, Moira Rose? The Her Story Pod.
Instagram.
Women of Her Story Podcast.
And visit our website at
funnyaccents.com/hello ofherstory.com.
And until next week, be safe, stay healthy, and show the world what you're made of.
We bid you adieu. Until then, wear a mask.